back on stage someday. Like we do in Honoring the Ancient Elders concert, where we'd honor the ancient elders we'd become. I said, Jim was a musician you could always trust on stage. And he was a person you could always trust off stage. I said, I don't have any regrets about my life with Jim. We didn't get to share the stage one last time, but he and I made art together. And we had so many adventures on the road. We laughed so much. I said, he and I were flying in a little plane together before 9/11, when you could see the pilots in the cockpit, when you could walk right up to them if you wanted. We were flying and hit some turbulence, and it felt like the plane almost flipped upside down. The plane was bumping up and down. It was scary. Jim and I were sitting across the aisle from each other. We looked at each other. Then we looked at the pilots. Those pilots looked at each other and laughed about the turbulence. So Jim and I looked at each other and laughed about the turbulence too. And I guess that's what I will always remember most about him. That will be my most lasting memory. My brother, Jim Boyd, laughing about turbulence. Shelley Boyd called me, I said to my wife. She asked if I would perform at the tribute to Jim in Buffalo. When? My wife asked. In a month, I said, at the Native American Music Awards. My wife looked into my eyes. We've been in love for 25 years. We know the what of the what about each other. I can't do it, I said. My brain. I will get too tired. I don't want to get all exhausted and start having seizures again. I have to stay home. And I don't want to fall over if Shelley is there. I'm not going to die, but think how much that would traumatize her. I know, she said. You have to tell her you can't go. But I didn't want to hurt Shelley's feelings. So I performed a highly sacred indigenous trick. I avoided making a final decision by avoiding the person who needed me to make my final decision. This didn't work when Indian tribes tried to avoid signing treaties with the U.S. government, and it didn't work when I tried to avoid Shelley. A few days after she'd asked me to consider performing at the tribute, Shelley texted me. If you and or Diane have time, I'm in town till Wednesday morning if you want to meet for lunch or dinner. I'm visiting the Burke. Located on the University of Washington campus, the Burke Museum has a cool collection of Native American art and artifacts. I'm not always a big fan of Native American museums or the Native collections of larger museums. I feel like museums too often lock us Natives in the past. But the Burke does a good job of honoring contemporary Native Americans while honoring our past. Plus, they have an Egyptian mummy in private storage and drawers filled with bird wings. After I read Shelley's message about the Burke, I called her. Hey, it's Sherman, I said. You better watch out. You're so Indian and beautiful, the Burke might catch you and put you in an exhibit. I'll be all right, as long as they put me in a canoe, Shelley said, and feed me lots of salmon. It'll be good salmon, too, I said. Remember, they still have wild salmon on this side of the mountains. That sounds better than how my life is going now, she said. I might do it. I could hear the grief in her voice. I didn't want to disappoint her about the tribute, but I had to tell her the truth. Shelley, I said, I'm sorry, but I can't do the show in Buffalo. I think it would cause me problems. I get so tired now. I would be too exhausted. Oh, Sherman, I understand. But I'm sad. We were thinking we'd get some of Jim's musician friends to learn one of the songs you and Jim did together. And then you'd perform it with his friends. And that would be the tribute. Oh, God, I said, and cried into the phone, fully understanding for the first time that Jim and I would never again perform together. I felt the full force of my grief. Oh, Shelley, I said, barely getting out the words. I don't think I could even make it through the first few bars of the song. I don't think I'd be able to talk. Oh, I know. I know, Shelley said. Sometimes I can barely talk about Jim. The sadness snuck up on me there, I said. It hit me hard like a storm. I realized at that moment that I'd have to stop listening to Jim's music for a while. In my family, we cut our hair to grieve death. In 2003, I'd scissored off my ponytail after my father died, and I never grew it back. I became a short-haired Indian. For my mother's death, I had no hair to cut. But I am writing this book about her. For Jim's death, I would have to put away the music he and I wrote together. I didn't know when I would be able to listen to it again. I miss Jim, I said to Shelley. I am always going to miss him. I am going to miss him forever, too, she said. You and I are alike, because I am going to miss your mom forever, too. I knew that Shelley and my mother had grown closer over the years, but I hadn't realized how close. I also knew that Shelley had, for personal and spiritual reasons, decided to learn how to speak her tribal language. My mother was one of the last fluent speakers of our tribal language, a dialect related to Shelley's language. Some words are the same or similar. Most are not. Your mom was so supportive of us learning our language, Shelley said. She encouraged us so much. I always wished she lived in Inchilim, so we could hear her talk all the time. It's a different language, I know, but we wanted to hear your mother speak it. We wanted to hear her fluency. We learn the language now, and we know phrases, and we can talk to each other, but not like your mom. I told her she should come talk to us in her language. I told her she could talk about cutting her toenails, and it would be beautiful to us. She never taught us how to speak the language, I said. And Shelley said, she didn't teach you because she loved you. That made me weep again. I couldn't talk for 10 or 15 seconds, and then I said, oh, Shelley, I have never heard it that clear. Sometimes, she said, you don't know something is true until you hear it for the first time. And I understood that Shelley, in learning to speak her tribal language, had tapped into something ancient and powerful. In reclaiming her language, Shelley now understood something beautiful and painful about the loss of language. And she had just taught me what she had learned. She had said it in English, but it spoke to my soul in the old way. I realized that my mother had not taught us the tribal language because she knew her children would not be strong enough to carry the responsibility of being the last fluent speakers. She protected us from that spiritual burden. She protected us from that loneliness. During my teen years, my mother sometimes said to me, "Junior, English will be your best weapon." I had always understood that as a motivational sentence, but I now realize it was also about love. And how psychic was my mother about my relationship with English? At the very least, she perfectly predicted my eventual job description. "Before your mom got really sick," Shelley said, "she was supposed to come to Inchalim and talk in Spokane to us. She was going to tell us stories. And then a big snowstorm hit and closed us off from the east, west, and south. But the north was open. Isn't that funny? A big snowstorm, but the north was open." I cried as I listened to Shelley speak. "Your mom called me and cried," Shelley continued. "She couldn't get through the snow. She was so sad. You know, Sherman, I get so mad at some of the people in your tribe. Your mom knew all the words, and those people wouldn't use your mother's knowledge. They wouldn't let her teach anywhere." I thought of how difficult my mother had been over the years, about how many enemies she made within our tribe. And then I thought about how my mother and I had stopped fighting, but had never truly reconciled. I thought about my poor, poor mother trying to reconcile with our tribe, with her enemies, and being turned away. "Shelley," I said, "Mom and I struggled with each other over the years." "I know. I know," she said. "I know." I sobbed again. "Is this who you're going to be now?" I asked. "Are you going to call up Indian men and make them cry?" "That might be good," Shelley said. "It might be fun to become an old Indian the heartbreaker." We laughed. "Your mother knew things that no other Spokane Indian knew," Shelley said. "Words, ideas, stories, songs, history. It's all gone now, buried with your mother." I suddenly understood that Shelley had become my teacher. And maybe, by loving my mother so much and being so loved by my mother in return, Shelley was also my mother's messenger. "Oh, shit," I said, "you are saying amazing things." "Oh, I'm just talking," Shelley said. "Just talking." I felt blessed by her words. "You know," she said, "our languages are amazing. Our languages do things that English just can't do. There's a word we use in Inchalim, and a word used in Wellpinit, too." Shelley said a word in Salish that I did not recognize, but I didn't ask her to repeat it, because I wanted her to keep telling the stories I did understand. "That word means earth dream. And, depending on how you use it, it means we, the people, are dreaming the earth into being. And it also means the earth is dreaming us the people into being. We are dreaming each other and making each other real. And it means other things too that I don't understand, that I might never understand. But I am going to keep learning. Shelley and I said our goodbyes and made plans to see each other in person. I told her that I would need to talk to her because of Jim and because of Lillian. I realized that Shelley would become my mother's voice, at least my mother's Salish voice. And I realized that my mother, Lillian, had dreamed me into being, and that I had dreamed her, my mother, into being, and that she and I would keep dreaming each other into being. I don't know the Spokane word or words that mean the son dreams the mother as the mother dreams the son. But I know how to say it in English. I know how to spell it. I know how to put it in a book. And that will make it magic enough for me. Chapter 148, Epigraphs for My Tombstone. 1. You shouldn't worry if you haven't lately heard me tell a joke about death. I'm just catching my breath. 2. I'm buried 279 miles from the graves of my mother and father. That seems perfect. No closer, no farther. 3. If I died as an elderly man in his unarmored sleep, then count my quiet departure as an indigenous victory. 4. Oh shit, crank the pulleys and lift me into the endless span. I hope to be remembered as the kind and generous man who always fought the bullies. 5. I'm sorry if I sneeze myself dumb, but I'm allergic to 78% of the dust, ashes, pollen, and plants that I've become. Chapter 149, After Brain Surgery. I forget what I was trying to say. One word or another gets in the way of the word I meant to use. Nothing stays. I forget what I was trying to say. So I say something else. I compensate. Like a broken horse, I've learned a new gait. But wait. Are these the words I meant to say? I think these rhymes help me to map the way. I think these rhymes help me to map the way. But wait. Are these the words I meant to say? Am I a broken horse? Is this my new gait? Damn. I've lost the path. So I'll compensate by repeating the words I meant to say. But these words migrate. They refuse to stay in place. This is my new life. My new way. I forget what I was trying to say. Chapter 150, Fluent. My friend, Shelley Boyd, a Kalvo Indian and dear friend of my late mother's, made an observation during a dinner that keeps echoing in my head. She pointed out that my siblings and I might be the youngest people who were raised in a household with two fluent Salish speakers, with a mother and father who were raised in households where they were fluent in Salish before they were fluent in English. Shelley said, "Both of your parents thought in Salish. They dreamed in Salish." But, as I told Shelley, I don't even think of my late father as being a fluent speaker because he so rarely spoke the language. In my lifetime, I heard him say Salish words maybe 10 times. Sometimes, when she was very angry, my mother yelled at my father in Salish, in the Spokane dialect, and my father listened, and listened, and listened, and then, maybe 2 or 3 times in all those years, he snapped a word or two back at her in Salish, something so powerful and shocking in the Spokane or Coeur d'Alene dialects that it would cause my mother to turn and immediately leave the room. And yet, my siblings and I are not fluent. My brothers and sisters, having lived on the reservation their entire lives, know far more words than me now. Growing up together, we shared the same limited vocabulary, but now, 26 years after I last lived on the res, I can barely count to 10 in Spokane. Our parents did not teach us our tribal language, and that was mostly because of shame. The white government, white military, and white church worked together to shame indigenous people for being indigenous, for speaking the language. But I also think our parents and grandparents hoarded the language. In a real sense, the original Salish language, in all of its dialects, was the most valuable treasure that any dispossessed Indian could hide, could keep for themselves. Being fluent is perhaps the last and best defense against American colonialism. So I think it was a combination of shame and possessiveness that prevented our parents from teaching us to be fluent. But Shelley also made this observation. "Sherman, I have known you for almost 30 years, and you have always been mysterious to me. I don't understand how your brain works, how you see the world as you do. But I was thinking about you the other day, about being raised by two people with Salish brains, who always thought first in Salish, who, since birth and until their death, watched the world with Salish eyes. And so I think that even though you and your brothers and sisters don't speak Spokane fluently, maybe all of you have these Salish English brains that nobody else has. Sherman, I think maybe your English has Salish hidden inside of it." I don't know if that's true. I have serious doubts that it's true. But my siblings and I do have a unique relationship with the Salish language, and with its tragic history of destruction, self-destruction, near disappearance, and recent resurgence. But the new Salish language is not the same as the old Salish language. "When a fluent elder dies," Shelley said, "it's like a river has disappeared. And inside the disappeared river are Salish words, Salish concepts that have also disappeared." My siblings and I could have been taught that old language. We could have learned how to navigate all of those ancient rivers of words and concepts. My siblings and I could have become the last guardians of the old Spokane language. But we are not. My siblings are everyday citizens of our reservation. They speak only English. And I, crazily enough, have turned English into my only vocation and greatest avocation. I speak and dream in English. I am a gifted writer and speaker of English, and that fact, in the small world of the Salish language and of the Spokane Indians, is cause for unequal amounts of celebration and grief. Chapter 151. Thursday is a good day to find an empty church where you can be alone. I want to believe that my father and mother have found each other in the afterlife and become a new kind of husband and wife. I hope they've built a home by water and have guest rooms for all of us sons and daughters. But I don't want to be the atheist who prays only for himself. So let me just say that my mother and father would certainly prefer to be alive and alive. Maybe they can return as birds. Listen, I know this magic will never happen. And maybe my faith or lack of faith is odd, but I don't need answers. I just want to be heard by somebody, by the real and or imaginary God. Chapter 152. Pine. And now I need to do something excessively Indian. So I will name all of the pine trees on the reservation. That one is Mother. And that one over there is Mother. And so is that third pine in the valley. And that tall one on the ridge is Mother. Okay. I'm either lazy or I have an arboreal strain of Oedipus complex. So let me take this down a few degrees. That pine, the closest one, to my mother's grave, I imagine its roots will eventually feed on what my mother will become after many years in the earth. So let my mother be that tree. And let that one tree be my mother. And let my mother tree turn every toxin into oxygen so that my siblings and I can finally and simply breathe. Chapter 153. Ancestry. My late mother is the grandmother of this poem. It is her descendant. Disrespectful enough to reveal that my late mother was conceived by rape. That most vicious of amendments. Unlike me, this poem will question my late mother about her conception and self-conception. I'm sorry to interrogate you. I know you're the victim and should be treated with respect. But there are things I'd like to know. When did you first learn you were the child of rape? Who told you? Why did they tell you? Should I even call him your father? Nobody wants to be known as a rapist's daughter, do they? I should tell everybody you were raised by a good man named James and not by your biological father, yes? Are you angry with me because I've revealed what you chose to conceal? I'm sorry for this intrusion, but I need to know if you saw the rapist's face when you looked into the mirror? Did your mother see him when she looked at you? Is it possible that your mother loved you less than your siblings because of how you were created? Did you ever learn how to be anything other than devastated? Okay, stop, stop. I want to stop this poem and drop the facade. I, Sherman Alexie, am the child of Lillian Alexie, who was the child of rape. I, Sherman Alexie, am the grandchild of rape. My children are the great-grandchildren of rape. All of these descendants exist because of rape. Rape is our ancestor. Rape is our creator. Rape is our book of Genesis. Rape is our Adam and Eve. And yet, we never forget that my mother chose my father because of love. I chose my wife because of love. Our children and grandchildren will choose their spouses because of love. We continue lovingly, despite the crimes committed against any and all of us. How miraculous is that? Dear mother, dear Lillian, thank you for choosing me. Thank you for your gifts, borrowed and renewed. Thank you for my birth and for all the plenitude of this half-vicious and half-forgiving earth. Chapter 154. Things I Never Said to My Mother. 1. I have 2 sons, your grandchildren, one dark-skinned and one light. That means they'll have to fight slightly different enemies. My dark son will have to be wary of angry white men with guns. My light son will have to verbally battle angry Indians with sharp tongues. 2. My sons ride city buses to and from school. They walk among thousands of strangers, arranging and rearranging themselves. There are so many new skyscrapers being built in our city of rain. I wonder if everybody's spirit animal is now the construction crane. 3. Dear mother, I live and work in a black neighborhood. Well, in a black neighborhood being gentrified. It's good. I love it here. Late one night, at my office, 1 mile from home, I stared out my window in an insomniac haze. Remember how crazed I used to be? Turns out, 8 hours of sleep is the only vision quest I need. Anyhow, as I stared out that window, I saw a transformer sizzle and spark down the block, accidental and gorgeous fireworks. Then, that transformer boomed and turned the neighborhood into one large and powerless room. In 5 minutes, the closed supermarket parking lot below me was crowded with dozens of black teens and young adults. A sudden party, and the bass that shook their car windows shook my office window. Then, 3 minutes after the party started, 6 police cars pulled into the parking lot. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. I wondered if somebody was going to get shot. But the cops stayed in their cars, content to just be reminders of more dangerous possibilities, while the black teens behaved like teens. 20 minutes later, the power came back. I was surprised that it had been fixed so quickly. Soon enough, The black kids vacated the lot, and the cops did too. It was one of those city nights where bad things could have happened. But it was good things that shook the air. The music and car engines and laughter, only singing about love, not disaster. 4. I ask my older son to define abundant, and he shrugs and says, "That's when you have too much stuff, like us." My younger son wants to maybe become a rapper, but he doesn't want to exploit black culture. He wants to tell his urban Indian truth, but he doesn't want to be a colonial asshole. He says, "Dad, I know I've got money and power, even though I'm just a kid, but I want to talk about all the evil shit in the world." I say, "Son, you just gotta be honest when you're trying to be a socially conscious artist in your village." And he says, "I'm gonna be honest from the start, because my rap name will be Lil Privilege." 5. Dear mother, at your funeral, your grandson said, "I didn't know her very well, and I think I missed out on good things, didn't I?" I said to him, "Kid, you didn't learn about some magic, that's true. But we have also kept you 292 miles removed from the tragic. I mean, you have never seen another Indian even take a sip of booze. That's the best kind of indigenous news." A few weeks later, back in Seattle, my son imitated me at the supermarket. He hunched over the cart, puffed out his belly, and said in his best Rez accent, "Aw, shit, I hate that tofu disguised as meat. It's phony. Now go find me some turkey bologna." I love that my sons trust me enough to mock me to my face. That's the best kind of familial grace. 6. I once saw the moon fully reflected in a mirrored skyscraper, then fracture into 100 moons as I drove under and beyond. There are a million freeway exits, and I've taken maybe 99 of them. There's a dude who sells hot dogs half price if you prove you're half in love. Everything, everything, everything can be installation art. 7. Mother, I know I was a sad little fucker. I cried all the time. It wasn't pretty. But I wasn't always crying because of you. I was crying because I was born to live in the city. And now I do. Thank God I do. Chapter 155, Tattoo. When they were very young and dating, my mother and father, Lillian and Sherman, got tattoos of each other's names on their left wrists. It was my mother's first and only tattoo. My father would eventually get 42 tattoos, but most of them were of the ink pen and lighter variety. He received none of them while sober, and he got at least a dozen of them while in jail. But my parents were sober and inexperienced when they got those first tattoos. They couldn't take the pain. So my father stopped his tattoo at L-I-L, short for Lillian, though nobody ever called my mother Lil. And my mother stopped her tattoo at SH. Chapter 156. Scrabble. In the last hours of writing the last draft of this book, I realized that memoir is a partial anagram for Mom Noir. Chapter 157. Public Art. At an open mic, I heard a poet proclaim that her sadness was a beached whale on the shore, and I complimented her on that metaphor. But the poem that she had performed was not the same as the poem that I'd heard. That poet seemed peeved by my misinterpretation and turned away. But I remain positive that her poem contained whales and sadness, and I happen to believe that my sadness does beach me like a confused whale, while my mania turns me into the loved child of a rescued whale and hummingbird, too wild to remain in the sea and too overscaled for flight. But wait, sometimes my mania lets me become the great blue whale hovering over a single orchid. Sometimes being bipolar lets me ignore physics. Ha! Who needs gravity? Look at me. Look at me. I am antimatter. I am mammal, and the opposite of mammal. My wings are carved from glass. My flukes are enamel. Watch me fly. Watch me fall. Applaud when I shatter. Chapter 158. What I Have Learned. The Spokane Indian word for salmon is pronounced shimshlits. The Spokane Indian word for a male's mother is pronounced skui. These are approximate pronunciations. This is phonetics. I can't say the words very well. I have not learned how to hear the words either. But I am practicing. I will never be fluent in my tribal language, but I believe these are the two most important words for me to know. My mother, skui. My salmon, shimshlits. My wild salmon, my wild mother, skui. Shimshlits, skui. My mother as salmon. My mother as salmon. Skui. Shimshlits. Chapter 159. Like a Bird. On a Saturday morning, in a hotel room in Bellingham, in an Oxford Suites that had three-dimensional art in the bathroom that spelled WASH in huge wooden capital letters, I confessed to my wife of 24 years that I had always been deeply ashamed of my acne-scarred back. Yes, she said. During the course of our long relationship, I'd admitted to a certain percentage of my various shames, like our marriage was a recipe, and I needed to add a small, precise amount of vulnerability, but not a teaspoon more, in order for everything to turn out well. I have never told you the full extent of my embarrassment, I said. I need to tell you now. So, okay. I have always moved and dodged and hid my back under sheets and pillows. I have used angles of light and shadows to avoid you being able to fully see my back. Even when we bathed or showered together, even during sex, I've operated like an escape artist for 2 decades. She didn't say anything. I couldn't tell what she was thinking. I tend to fall in love with the unnameable. Then she spoke. I've seen your back, she said. I want you to see it better, I said. Okay, she said. She looked amused, irritated, slightly baffled. She knew that she was again part of two narratives, one that was happening in real time and another that I was revising and editing even as the first was taking place. That two simultaneous narratives shit must be equally aggravating and attractive to the non-writer lovers of ever-distracted writers. This freaks me out, I said, but I am going to get naked and lie face down on the bed. And I want you to look at my back. I want you to study my back. I want you to study my scars. I want you to tell me what they look like. I want you to touch the scars. I want you to trace their outlines with your fingertips. I want to feel you feeling my scars. I felt an odd combination of fear, pride, and idiocy, like I was about to jump out of a plane into deep woods where I would hunt a brown bear with a pocket knife. And so I allowed my wife, who'd seen me naked and touched me thousands of times, to finally touch me in those places where I had hoarded so much of my pain and shame. Before I met my wife, a Hidatsa Ho-Chunk Potawatomi Indian, I had never, as an adult, been romantically loved by any other Native woman. But don't feel too bad for me. Growing up on the rez, as a preteen, I kissed four girls. In kindergarten, I grew so dizzy while sitting on a spinning merry-go-round that I laid my head back on the metal and closed my eyes. A few moments later, I opened my eyes and was startled to see a girl staring down at me. Then I was even more startled when she kissed me, jumped off the merry-go-round, and never kissed me again. That merry-go-round kisser was a white girl, the daughter of white parents who worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I kissed a girl for the second time in fourth grade when I leaned through her open basement bedroom window and smashed my mouth into hers. She was a white girl, and she fell laughing back onto her bed next to her best friend, an Indian girl, who asked, "What was it like?" "He tastes like salt," the white girl said. They laughed together. I ran away, fearing something was wrong with my mouth. Only much later in life, after I had kissed other girls, did I realize that the taste of salt can make a kiss pretty damn spectacular. In fifth grade, I kissed a white girl who was a little bit Indian, or maybe she was an Indian girl who was mostly white. In any case, on the rez, she was treated and mistreated like she was a white girl, no matter how Indian she was or was not. I think she was the first girl I loved. One day, at recess, she gave me a necklace, a silver cross. Then she kissed me. I realized that I had always wanted her to kiss me. That's a powerful feeling at any point in one's life, but it's a naked Las Vegas Cirque du Soleil of the soul the first time you feel it. I lived across the road from the tribal school, so I immediately ran home and asked my mother if she had a necklace I could give to my first love. And my mother smiled, said yes, and gave me a silver necklace with a pendant coin that featured an embossed buffalo on one side and an Indian head on the other. That piece of jewelry was not exactly romantic, but I didn't know any better. I guess my mother didn't know any better either, and despite my mother's other major and minor crimes against me, I absolutely refuse to believe that she deliberately sabotaged her young son's courtship effort. Proudly swinging that half-Indian, half-buffalo necklace, I ran back to school and presented it to that mostly white girl. She accepted the gift, but with a look of such obvious disdain that I turned and ran. And, as I ran, I heard her laughing with other girls, the mostly and fully Indian girls who had often laughed at me, at my thick government-provided eyeglasses, at my large hydrocephalic skull, at my epically crooked teeth, at my stutter and lisp. I was a special needs kid before needs were considered special. I was a kid somewhere on the spectrum, when the spectrum was only normal or not normal. I was the official tribal fool, living 100 years after fools were last thought to be holy. I was a mess, a mysterious casserole slowly going bad in a half-assed freezer. I was social carrion. I was nearsighted in one eye and farsighted in the other. I was uncorrected and uncorrectable. I was the boy who cannot contain his emotions. I was the kid who could not run fast or jump high. I was the kid scared of heights on a reservation that is essentially an endless pine forest. I was the Indian who didn't know how to swim on a reservation bordered on two sides by one great river and one damn good river. I was the runt of the rez. I stole my fourth and last reservation kiss from another white girl. I was in sixth grade. She was an older woman, an eighth grader. She was the white daughter of white teachers. And I saw her sitting on a big rock on the playground. Her eyes were closed. Her face was turned toward the October sun. I quietly climbed a rock, leaned toward her, and kissed her. She slowly opened her eyes, not surprised at all, as if she'd expected to be kissed by somebody, and said, "Never do that again." She was absolutely justified in judging and rebuffing me that way. Later that same school year, I was sitting on a second flight of interior school stairs while two Indian girls sat talking on the first flight of stairs. I could hear every word they said, but they didn't know I was listening. They talked about their friends, all the girls they thought were the coolest and the ones who were the least cool. And then they talked about the boys they liked and the boys they loved. I wanted to hear them talk about me, but I also wanted them not to talk about me. "You know who you should like?" the first Indian girl asked the other Indian girl. "Who?" she asked. "Junior," said the first Indian girl. She said my name. Oh, shit. She said my name. "Junior is nice," said the second Indian girl. "And he's super smart. But he is so ugly." I know that every person listening to this has experienced that kind of romantic devastation and personal destruction. But it doesn't make me feel any better to know that it's a universal experience. And I hope only a few people have experienced what happened to me after that moment on the stairs. The next day, some other Indian girls began to call me ugly. They said it to my face, in public, at school, at sporting events, at ceremonies, everywhere. When they walked by my house, they'd yell, "Ugly!" loud enough for me to hear it in my basement bedroom. Insulting me suddenly became a wildly popular thing to do. I'd been randomly bullied and insulted for years, but I quickly became the target of an organized harassment campaign. so many insults, so many names. They invented a disparagement for me that I'm embarrassed to repeat so many years later. "Junior high honky," they chanted at me. "Junior high honky, junior high honky." That's a stupid insult, right? Inane. It hardly seems like it would be damaging. But, like water falling drop by drop onto your face for hours and days and weeks, that tiny insult slowly came to have enormous power over me. So how do those mean girls invent that particular appellation? What is its etymology? Junior high honky, junior high honky. Such a silly damn insult. I was an Indian being racially insulted by other Indians. I was being called white by Indians who had a white mother or father. I was being called white by Indian kids who'd known me since our births. Many of us had played together as babies in cribs, so they were racially insulting me for the whiteness they knew I didn't possess. Well, my maternal grandfather was partly descended from a Scottish traveler, but he died years before I was born. Some of my uncles, aunts, and cousins had married white folks and had biracial kids, but every one of my living blood relatives was an official member of one tribe or another. A few of my cousins were distant urban Indians. That didn't make them any less Indian. It just meant they weren't reservation Indians. But I was the child of two reservation Indians who were the children of reservation Indians who were the children of reservation Indians. It was ridiculous and maddening to be called white by Indians who were less Indian than me. As an adult, I can now intellectually understand why they called me white. In the Indian world, white is our enemy. White is the conqueror. White is the liar, killer, and rapist. So, if one Indian wants to inflict a grievous emotional wound on another Indian, then white is the big fucking gun of insults. The bullies wanted to hurt me as much as possible. So, despite the fact that I was culturally, economically, politically, racially, and geographically a full member of the tribe, as much a Spokane Indian as any other Spokane, I was called white, not because I was white, but because I was the frail kid. I was the easiest target. In the land of others, I was the other-est. These days, you can go online and read other indigenous people's scholarly and less than scholarly reviews of my books, and you'll discover that some of those assholes overtly and subtly accuse me of whiteness. And sure, it hurts my feelings. It definitely gives me PTSD flashbacks to childhood shame. But it also makes me shrug, sigh, and laugh. I used to be bullied because I was the Indian with the least social power. Now, I'm sometimes bullied because I'm one of the Indians with the most social power. So yeah, when another Indian, especially one of the smart ones chasing that completely non-assimilative prize known as academic tenure, accuses me of whiteness, I think, different bully, same bullying. And sometimes, when I'm being the best version of myself, I will remember that bullies are created. That bullies seek to torture because they've been tortured. When other Indians, friends, acquaintances, or strangers, talk shit about me, I try to remember they are acting out of their own weakness, their own crisis of self-identity, their own pain and fear and paranoia. I try to instantly forgive them. I try. but my adult understanding of this indigenous cultural cruelty does nothing to help the bullied Rez kid I was. My intellectualism, empathy, and self-empathy cannot time travel.